You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Las Vegas.
It's more than just a city.
It's a feeling.
It's that feeling of excitement when you spot the lights of the Strip out the airplane window.
It's that feeling of awe as you stroll down the boulevard, taking in the sights and sounds.
And it's that feeling of satisfaction knowing that you're in the greatest city in the world.
Over 42 million people from around the world share that feeling every year.
And I'm one of them.
Taking you to the world-famous Vegas Strip and beyond, my name is Jeff, and this is Jeff Does Vegas. Welcome to From the Vault, a special series of episodes of Jeff Does Vegas. Over the 5 years I ran this podcast, from 2019 to 2024, I released over 180 episodes. And along the way, I talked to some very cool Vegas insiders, entertainers, and local experts. I also shared lots of tips and travel advice and explored the fascinating history of the city. I thought it might be fun to take a little trip back in time and reshare some of those episodes. So, whether you're a longtime follower looking for a re-listen, or you're a Vegas fanatic who just happened to stumble across the show, welcome. I hope you'll stick around for this conversation from the vault. There are some awesome Vegas movies out there. Classics like Casino, Ocean's 11, and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. There are also some terrible Vegas movies out there. The incredible Burt Wonderstone, 3,000 Miles to Graceland, and Paul Blart Mall Cop 2 come to mind. I think it's fair to say that the film up for discussion in this episode of the podcast falls somewhere in the middle. Considered to be one of the biggest box office bombs of all time, 1995's Showgirls, written by Joe Esterhaus, directed by Paul Verhoeven, and starring Saved by the Bell's Elizabeth Berkley, has morphed into a huge cult classic. Thanks to its steady stream of nudity and gratuitous sex, the film garnered an NC-17 rating, and to this day remains the only film with that rating that had a wide release in mainstream theaters across the U.S. And although Showgirls wasn't based on a true story per se, Esterhaus and Verhoeven claimed they did extensive interviews with people in the Vegas entertainment community to make the portrayal of the world of the showgirl as accurate as possible. So, did they get it right? We're about to find out. And who better to tell us than an actual Las Vegas showgirl? Making her second appearance on the podcast is Dani Elizabeth, a former cast member of the legendary Las Vegas shows Jubilee and Crazy Girls. Dani shared the story of the first time she saw Showgirls and how it almost led to a career change. We dove deep into the film with some character analysis and theories on why people watch Showgirls over and over again, and we compared Dani's life as a showgirl to that of Nomi Malone's. Please enjoy my conversation with Dani Elizabeth. I have to be totally honest with you. There was a part of me that was a bit nervous about asking you to come on the podcast for this episode because you are like a legitimate Las Vegas entertainer who's worked as a showgirl in some pretty big productions. And there was a part of me that was concerned that you were going to be offended if I reached out to you and said, hey, can you come on my podcast and have a conversation about this goofy movie that basically mocks a business that you were a part of for a very long time?
I mean, you have to know that is asked by like the average person at least like one out of three times. And somebody will say, so is like being a showgirl, is it really like Showgirls? And some people feel a little shy to ask. And some people are just like, yeah, tell me everything. But it's honestly because, I mean, what are the percentage of showgirls in the world that have actually worked in a production show? It's very small, right? There's like handfuls compared to the amount of people in this world. So how would anyone really know? And there's never been, which I think there should have been, there's never been like a backstage, like reality show with all the reality things, all the garbage TV. It would be cool, even if, you know, because part of the problem is it's topless. So they couldn't bring cameras because at Jubilee, they did talk about it. But no, I think it's a very valid question. I still get asked that by many people all the time. And you can't be offended by it because that's all people really know, unless they've gone and seen a show. And even then they're like, what's really happening behind scenes? Like when the curtain closes, I get it.
Well, that makes me very happy then. I'm glad that you have a good sense of humor about the whole thing and that you were able to make some time to come on and have a conversation with me. So I really appreciate it. Let's start off talking about the movie itself and the first time you ever saw Showgirls. Do you remember the first time you saw the movie?
I do. I'm pretty sure I was in high school because I think the movie came out in 95. So I was a little too young then, but when I was in high school, I saw it and they used to play it on like HBO late night TV. And that's like back when we, you know, had, if you had like all the channels, you would sit and watch TV and cause we didn't stream things like in the early 2000s really. And I remember just sitting around like, and I think I came across it on TV and I'm like, what is this movie? This is so strange. And I think I was actually with a couple of my friends from high school and they're like, we were just sitting there just talking about it. I'm like, what is this bizarre? And I was like, wow. And I remember as a kid being like, whoa, is that, cause I've been a dancer since I was 4 years old. And I'm like, wow. Like I always thought it would be so cool to be able to have a career as a dancer when you get older. Right. It seems like a dream job. And when I saw that, I was like, wow, if that's what it's like, then I don't think I want to be a dancer when I grow up.
So that first impression of the movie, then it almost scared you right out of a career.
Yes, absolutely. Because of all of the things that you see this character, Elizabeth Berkley, which, by the way, when, you know, 2099, like around those few years, Saved by the Bell growing up when before that was, I watched that all the time. Like, and then they would play it before school would start. So we'd have it on like in the TV, you know, behind. And I was just obsessed with that show. And so I was like, oh my gosh, Elizabeth Berkley, like, what did she do when she grew up in her career? And I see this movie, I'm like, oh wow, that's what she did. Cool. But I'm not sure I want to be a dancer anymore.
So over all these years now that you've been watching the movie, how many times do you think you've seen it?
Oh man. I mean, gosh, it's been, what has it been now? Like since I first saw it, it's been probably about 22 years. It's probably been hundreds, you know, bits and pieces, hundreds. It's like, and it's not one of those things that I'm like, oh yeah, I haven't seen Showgirls in a year. I've got to watch that this weekend. It's not that vibe. It's just one of those things that it's always around, you know, it's always pops up and it's always pushed in different areas. Like I said, when I was younger, it was always on late night on HBO. And then I've seen it on streaming devices. It's like one of those movies that you're like, oh, cool. Like, I just want to like zone out to something now. And it's one of those things that I'll just pop on and I'm like, oh yeah, this is great. Like while I'm working on something or it just has that connection to it. And I don't even really understand how or why. I've got a couple theories on it, but it's just amazing to me how this movie, it was such a flop when it first came out. And it's still something that we talk about. I mean, this conversation, right? Like it was wild.
Yeah. You know what? I'm with you on that. It's not one of those movies that I'll go out of my way to watch, but if I'm flipping through the guide on the cable box and I see that Showgirls is on, yeah, I'll flip to the channel and I'll watch it. Even if it's the broadcast TV version where everything is bleeped out and things are blurred out and it's been edited down, I will even watch that version.
100% same. Sometimes I even like that version better because it's to have it on in the background or while you're doing something. the unedited version can be very distracting because you're like, ooh, like there's some cringy moments, whether it's just like super cheesy or just like super over the top. And so I like both versions. I'll take either or.
You mentioned cringy moments in the movie. And I mean, there's a lot of them. But I mean, for you, what would you say is the most cringy moment of the movie for you?
Well, I mean, the first one that comes like right out of that is, on a serious note, is the note, the place where Molly, Nomi's friend, right? I think that's the character's name, Molly, where she's raped by this celebrity. Mm-hmm. And that moment is just so painful to watch. And we've seen, we're not jaded to scenes like that, but for some reason in this movie, it still is cringy for me. And I think it's maybe also because the dynamic between who Molly is as a person. So she's so not a part of that world. She is, because she does wardrobe for the show. But she's such a good hearted, she's the only good hearted person really in the entire movie. She's the only one that you're like, oh, like I could be friends with that person, because everybody else, they show this evil side to every person. So to see the only character that has a heart and that happened to her, and you're so committed to her because you get to know her throughout the movie. And maybe that's the reason why it's extra cringy. But that's a cringe one. Right from the very beginning, when the movie opens up, where Elizabeth Berkley gets her knife out in the car, and it's not, there's nothing that happens, but just that scene, and she's just all hard, and she's like, I got my knife and I'm a badass. And it's like, okay, well, yeah, like you asked him basically to pull over. You chose to get in the car. Like, you could start maybe a little less threatening, but you know, maybe that was her way of saying, yeah, I need this ride, but don't mess with me.
It is interesting that you bring up the point about Molly being the only good person in the movie. I hadn't watched the movie for a very long time. And of course, before we had this conversation, I sat down and really watched it in earnest. And I had actually kind of forgotten about that scene where Molly gets raped by Andrew Carver, by the famous singer and all of his goons. And as I'm watching the movie, it was almost like something was triggered in my brain. I'm watching it and it's coming up to that part and I'm thinking, oh God, oh shit, this is about to happen. Why you got to do that to poor Molly? She's the only good person in the movie. And upon further analysis, you're absolutely correct. She is legitimately the only good person in the entire film.
Yeah. She's the only nice one. And even Nomi's, I forget what his name is, but the dancer guy that she meets that like kind of wants to protect her and help her out and stuff. He's got some nice moments, but he still does some really cringy, you know, things. They weren't in a relationship, but he was, you know, with another girl, and kind of, I think Nomi felt betrayed by that. And, you know, he just said some really harsh things to coming out of a good place, but he just had some really cringy, like kind of evil moments as well. Whereas Molly, just the most innocent character. And it's so interesting, like, to see how there's only one, and they had to have done that on purpose to show this whole evil, evil world. And then this one pure little spirit. And I think that helped to make the impact of that scene so much harsher.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, what is it you think that makes this movie the type of movie that people will watch over and over and over again? I mean, it's a terrible movie. There's no question that it's not a good movie. And I mean, everything from terrible dialogue to gratuitous nudity to cringeworthy sex scenes to just all of it. It's not a stellar film. And yet here we are, still talking about it and still watching it on a very regular basis. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I have a couple different theories on that, and maybe it's different for everyone. I know for me, I feel like it's like watching a train crash, right? Like you can't take your eyes off of it. It's like, oh, that's so bad. It's so bad. It's so good kind of thing. And I know for me personally, and I probably have a little bit of a biased opinion about this because I am a dancer, and now I have worked and a showgirl production show, but I just love all of the moments that they show when they're on stage. I mean, the production value of the moments. Yes, there is very cheesy movements and some cheesy interactions on stage, but I just love watching. I'm like, oh my gosh, like to be a performer, it reminds me of the show I did, Jubilee, where you're on stage with 100 people and you've got fire coming up and water and, you know, they're riding motorcycles out. Like the show I worked in wasn't even to that extent. So there's some really just cool shots and scenes in the movie. And if you're a fan of Vegas, which, you know, I'm a huge fan, I love seeing all the different places that they'll film things. And I, you know, you see the casinos, and now because the movie did take place in 95, so much here in Vegas has changed. So when you look at something, you're like, oh, wow, like, look at that casino, or that looks different. And so I love that aspect of it. But I also have been told that this movie was kind of brought to life very quickly by the queer community. And since it came out, like drag queens are like, oh my gosh, I'm Nomi, you know, and they're, you know, they even have made plays about it. And in that community, it's still a huge thing. They always talk about it. And so over the years, I've had a lot of friends tell me, like, bring that up. And I'm like, why are you guys like talking about that? And they're like, girl, like you saw the way she did her nails, I'm doing that to mine. So I'm like, really? Like, it's still a very talked about movie and admired movie by the community. So I think that that's helped to keep it alive. And then I think the rest of us just really enjoy watching trains crash into things.
It really is the ultimate train wreck movie. I mean, as you say, you can't look away from this film, whether it's the terrible dialogue or the gratuitous nudity or the horrible sex scenes or any of it. I mean, again, you can't look away. And as you say, I mean, the show that they do in this film, Goddess, it really is an incredible show. The production value is pretty amazing. And you can almost picture yourself is sitting in the audience watching that show.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. It makes you want to be at that show or in the show. I mean, it's so glamorous. And then, you know, the interviews that they have with the principal dancers after, and they'll be out and, you know, random people will come up to them and asking for autographs. Like they really put the glamour in the aspect of what it's like to be a showgirl.
And that being said, that was my main reason for wanting to get you on the podcast to have this conversation about the film Showgirls. Having been an actual showgirl in actual Las Vegas productions, I wanted to see exactly how close to reality this film got. Now, admittedly, this movie is not based on a true story by any stretch of the imagination, but the director and the writer of the movie, Paul Verhoeven and Joe Esterhaas, they claim that they did extensive interviews with strippers and showgirls and choreographers and directors and producers and hotel and casino owners to try to get this as close to reality as possible. So I wanted to find out from somebody who actually is involved in the business how close to the mark they actually got.
Yeah.
We're going to start off with the audition process. Nomi's audition process, she is scouted at the strip club that she works at. She goes in with a few other girls. She meets the prick producer, supremely played by Alan Rakins, who is bald but wearing a toupee for this particular movie. She goes through the motions. She storms out of the audition and somehow still manages to land the gig. I am going to go out on a limb. I'm willing to bet that your audition process was nothing like this.
Not even close. Way different. And now, you know, keep in mind, maybe in the 80s, you know, there were more cringy moments for dancers. But when I auditioned, you know, in the last, I'd say 20 years or so, things have become a lot more corporate, and, you know, there's HR departments and PC, politically correct moments that have to be honored. So when I auditioned, it's just like going to any other audition. You wear a leotard or, you know, briefs and like a two piece. And it actually is a very extensive audition process. We had to do, learn tap choreography. We had to learn jazz choreography, and then we had to do ballet across the floor. So it took a few hours to get through it. And then after that, yes, they do bring you into a private room. And Diane Palm, she was the company producer for Jubilee. And she started in Jubilee when it first opened as a dancer in it. And then she moved up. And so then, because Don Arden was no longer around, and the company producer Fluff, she took Diane in as the assistant. And then when I finished, she was now the company producer. But it was very professional. And then they would, after the audition, if they kept you, one by one, take you into a private room, like a little office, and they could take one at a time. And you would take your top off so that she could see, because they also wanted to make sure that you didn't have implants, because that was not preferred. They preferred small and pretty over huge and fake. So they would do that, but it was felt very comfortable, and she was very professional and very caring about it. And then after that, we'd go back out into the main room, and then they would also measure us, our height. So we'd stand up against the wall, and she would write that down as well, just to make sure that no one's lying on the resume, because we all try to get a little bit extra in there. Because if you don't know, the taller you are, the better it is to land a showgirl job. And then that's it. And then you go home and you wait for a phone call. And then when she called me, and she was like, yes, Danny, so we'd like to offer you the position. And they have two different positions. You're either a bluebell or a showgirl, which is like the bluebell are covered dancers, and the showgirls are topless dancers, which Diane said that she didn't even really like to use the term showgirl, because she thought that showgirl didn't honor how much you actually dance. She thinks, because back when this whole showgirl thing came about, the showgirls were more statuesque. So they were the 6'2" Amazon women that wore the big giant costumes in the back. And then all the other dancers would be in front, and some were topless, some weren't. And now that has changed. And at Jubilee, if you were the showgirl or topless track, you still dance just as much as the covered track did. But so when she called me and asked me if I would take the position, I, of course, jumped right on it, and then went into moved to Vegas. And we had about a month long rehearsal process.
So what you're saying then is, at no point did anybody hand you a bowl of ice and say, take your top off and show me your, speaking of cringy moments, that was without a doubt one of the cringiest.
Super cringy. I was like, whoa, no wonder why she stormed out of there. I would too. And no, it's so not like that. It's so much more, at least from my experience. Again, I don't know if somebody in the 80s felt differently, but I know at Jubilee, it wasn't like that. Even when Don Arden, the head producer, and I've heard stories that he might have been a little bit, had some of those aspects of like the sleazy producer moments, but he was a very professional, producer, and cared about his dancers to the end. So I would have to say, yeah, that's definitely a very embellished scene.
You talked about after you landed your gig in Jubilee, it was a month's worth of rehearsals before you were into the show. Slightly different story compared to what the hero of our movie, Nomi Malone, goes through, where she, after storming out of her audition, she still gets the gig, and she shows up at the office that morning in her Versace dress.
Yes.
And then after only one afternoon of rehearsals, she is swung into the production that night. What you're telling me is that doesn't happen.
No, absolutely not. We had rehearsals 6 days a week, and maybe it was a little less than a month, but no, I'm pretty sure it was about a month of rehearsals, because you not only do you have to learn all of the numbers, but then you have to learn, when you have 100 people on stage, you have to know your traffic, and that takes time. That takes just as much time to learn that, if not more, than the actual choreography. Because if you have 100 people and everybody's moving and you're just a slight hair out of place, and I've seen it happen, you'll get whacked by somebody else's costume that's sticking 5 feet off their back, you know? So yeah. And the other moment too is when she becomes the principal, the lead, and then she jumps into that, like, that night. I'm like, you didn't have any rehearsals whatsoever. Like, that's a difficult spot to learn, you know, that quickly. It's very, very embellished, but obviously I don't think the director of the movie cared so much about the logistics of, you know, that side. He was more about the drama. That's what he spent time with in that movie.
Do you remember the first time you hit the stage with Jubilee?
Yes. I was extremely nervous. I wasn't nervous about being topless. I forgot I was even topless. I was nervous that, some of these costumes are huge. You have to, and that's another thing, in rehearsals, you spend time getting fitted for the wardrobe, and you do one run through with all the costumes on. And sometimes with the rehearsals, like, you might put your hat on, just feel the weight, but it's a very new feeling having those costumes on when you do your first show. And not to mention all of the pieces that go with it. You have a big jewelry armband, and you have like a wristband. Sometimes you have these necklaces and the bras and all the things that snap and this and that. So I was nervous that, do I have all my pieces? Do I have everything on? I'm not going to lose something on stage. I have the right backpack. Is my hat going to stay on? Because how distracting is that when it starts sliding and you're trying to dance on a football field size stage? So I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. And I felt like I was having an outer body experience. But people will ask me all the time, they're like, was it because it was the first time you were topless in front of all those people? I'm like, I forgot I was even topless. I mean, it feels like you're wearing more clothes when you have those costumes on, because some of them are so heavy and so complex.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Other than just general overall nervousness, were there any specific fears that you had when you walked out onto the stage for that very first show?
One of my biggest fears, and this fear actually would come back every once in a while. And I had to play some mind games with myself. And I'm not the only one. I had other friends that like had these thoughts and moments. But one of my biggest fears for the finale scene, there is a cascade of stairs that come down. And so we come up from the back and walk down the stairs, and it's like hundreds of stairs. And when you wear these finale costumes, you can't look down, because you look down, the weight of the headdress will cause you to topple forward. So there's a technique that you do when you're walking. You look straight out and you feel with the back of your heel and you feel the stair, and you do that down hundreds of stairs. And so my biggest fear, and that's what everybody talked about in rehearsals, they're like, don't stress about the stairs and the costume, you'll be fine. But that night, that first full week, I was always nervous about the finale stairs, because there were stories of women that had gone down. And about a year later, I skipped a stair. I don't know what, maybe my adrenaline was going. I don't know if there was somebody in the audience or something, But I went down. I thought I felt it. I skipped it and I caught myself, but I, and you can't look down. So you're just hoping and praying that your feet will find a stair before your face does. So,
oh my God.
So yeah, that was the biggest fear that night. I'm like, I would rather go out there butt naked. It'll have all my costumes fall off of me than go tumbling down the stairs, because it's happened to other people and they even became injured over it.
Did you count the stairs? Like, did you know in your head there's 147 stairs here? And if all of a sudden you got to the bottom and you only counted 146, it was like, yeah. Oh shit. Which one did I miss?
At one point I did, and 100 might be a little bit of an exaggeration. There might've been more like 64 stairs, 60, something like that. But I would count them, because in the music, depending on which track you're in, you might go down 8 stairs and then you pause and there's somebody next to you and there's like 6 people in front of you, a couple stairs down, spaced in between each person, and the same with behind you. But you would have these moments where then you pause and you do something with your arms and it's like, beautiful girls, and it's a picture-esque type moment. And then you would have to travel like inward and outward on the stairs as you're going down. And so you create these formations of these women in these beautiful costumes with these pause moments. So I would count, because the hardest ones were when you had to travel inward as you're going downstairs to hit the middle of this staircase that's like half a football field wide, and all these women making different patterns. So I would count, so I would know, okay, I am now like, or I would count it in the music. I am now like 1/8 countdown. This is the right stair. So don't freak out. Cause one time I skipped a stair. Now I'm like, oh, I'm not on the same, on the right stair. And then you get off your leg. And cause everybody has a different leg they have to start with. The girls on the left side, the girls on the right side. So that you see this pattern of legs and costumes going downstairs.
Just all it's going to take is that one little lapse in concentration to just completely throw you totally out of whack.
100%. And whatever you do, the number one rule was don't look down, because I think that's a very common thing. If we trip as humans going downstairs or just walking, I'm the most clumsy person off stage. I trip just over a carpet. And the first thing we do is we look down, because we're like, oh no, what's going on? What's happening? Like, oh. But when you're on those stairs and you trip or you miss something or your heel catches the lip of the stair weird, you just have to have faith in the process that you know exactly how to get your feet settled again. Because the second you look down, like I said, the weight of those headdresses, it will cause you tumbling. And so that's the scariest thing. You're like, I can't even, it's like out of your control.
A few months ago, I went down the steps of my back deck here, and that's like 3 steps. And I don't even know what happened, but my brain just temporarily disengaged and was like, okay, you don't know how to walk anymore. And so down I went, and it was so embarrassing, but I can't even imagine doing that with, like 60 steps and 15 pounds of whatever on my head and not being able to look down. If all of a sudden you forget how to walk for a moment, you need your brain to kick back into gear so that you can figure it out and get back into sync without killing somebody.
Yes, 100%. And then you worry about sticking out like the sore thumb, because when you have, you know, 30 girls going down the staircase and everybody's doing choreographed stair stepping, and then one person trips and now you're off the stair. Well, you're going to stick out the entire way until you get down to the bottom of that staircase, unless you figure out how to get back on it.
All of a sudden it's a Naked Gun sketch is what's
exactly. Exactly.
There is a lot of drama backstage at the production of Goddess, everything from the opening act causing issues, the opening act, of course, monkeys, which apparently poop on the stage and get loose and run around backstage in the dressing room areas, to fights between the girls, full on brawls between the girls over everything from makeup to boyfriends to whatever. And then, of course, this all culminates in one dancer intentionally spilling beads on the stage to injure another dancer, to take her out of the show. And then, of course, Nomi pushing Crystal down the stairs in a fit of rage in order to take her spot as the principal dancer in the show. I'm guessing all of this complete and utter bullshit. You never saw anything like this at any of your shows.
Yes. That stuff didn't happen. I think, you know, they're always, look, if you're going to work in a place that has 20 people or 100 people, there's going to be people that you just don't like or don't get along with. That's just the way the world works. But no one ever sabotaged anyone. No one, I mean, first of all, they'd be fired on the spot if something like that happened. And secondly, most of the people, I mean, I'd say 9.5 out of 10, they were always the loveliest people. I mean, part of the audition process was also having a conversation, you know, and looking at your resume and the things you've done. Like, you know, if the show was, and not that there's anything wrong with being a dancer in a strip club, but most of the time they don't have a lot of dance technique, and that's the industry that they're in. And so if you went to audition for a show and on your resume, because you have to have a resume and a headshot, it's a professional setting. And if on your resume, you only had a list of strip clubs that you worked at, you wouldn't even be asked to stay for the audition. They would have dismissed you right after the first opening couple things that you learned. So no, it definitely wasn't like that. But I think to go back to what you were saying before, I think that those moments, everybody wants it to be like that, right? Because it's the drama. And I think that those satirical type qualities in the movie is what helps people coming back to it, right? It's campiness, it's cheesy, like the camp phenomenon of what makes this the most epically bad movie. It keeps you coming back, right? And I think the entire movie is a bit of a satire, but not just of like a showgirl production show or being in that world, but of the entertainment business in general. And so I think there's a lot of moments there. And as we've seen now over the years, like the Me Too movements and all of these things that have come about with some very respected people in entertainment that, you know, has shocked me to hear some of these things. I think that these guys that put this movie on had some of this because they already knew about these things going on. And I think that they were kind of like, ha, 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 like the god, like, this is my way of making a joke about it. But little do you know, this is really like how things are happening in Hollywood and of this nature. So I think that there's a little bit of a deeper message there that they had a fun time kind of putting out there. And then also it's like, because who doesn't want to watch like topless showgirls sabotage each other and like fall down a flight of stairs, damsel in distress, you know?
So what you're saying, and I say this somewhat tongue in cheek, is that Joe Esterhaas and Paul Verhoeven, they didn't just set out to make a raunchy NC-17 movie, but they were almost ahead of the curve on a movie that was social commentary on the state of the entertainment industry.
Yeah, I think that a lot of those moments 100% are not and not maybe done in a way like some people argue, you know, well, this movie really is about like female empowerment and woman power. And yeah, there are some moments of the movie, like the main character, you know, she's leaving her little small town, or we don't even know, she's from different places. I think she says that many times throughout the movie. And, you know, just that in general keeps people wanting to come back because it's that inspiring tale of, you know, the classic tale of someone leaving their past behind to go chase their big dream in the big city. And in that moment, it's like, oh, okay, yes, like I want to know her story. Like, is she going to make it? So in some regards, yes, there are female empowerment moments. And yeah, dancing topless, it's very empowering. I find that empowering. But then some of the other sleazy undertones, he's saying, yes, this is about female empowerment. But also don't forget that, like, there's a dark side to the world and we're running it, mm-hmm. You know, because that whole the whole rape scene, too. Just how they're all connected. And then that terrible conversation when the one producer calls and tries to fake ream out the guy for kind of soliciting the dancer, but he already knew about it. So he did it to kind of cover up, you know, all of it. It's like this group of like evil men that are just like, kind of like, oh, you're my showgirl puppet. So these women think they're empowered, but at the same time, they really have only a few, you know, options to at hand to, to deal with.
Yeah. And I would say that some of that female empowerment side of the movie makes its way into the scene where Nomi gets her revenge on Andrew Carver.
That's one of my favorite scenes, by the way.
Yeah. She shows up at his hotel room and then just proceeds to beat the living snot out of the guy for what he did to her friend. This is really something that, in all honesty, I don't think I had ever seen anything like that in a movie before then.
Mm-hmm. And she does. And I love that. And it brings up that moment of like, when you're so far low, because you see all this happen to her and then she's so beat up in the hospital. And even Nomi is like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this happened. And she feels terrible. And then she goes and gets back a little bit of like, you know, some gratification for her friend and for herself. But it only goes so high, because I know it's not part of the movie, but deep down inside, I'm like, well, I want the police to come and lock this guy up. Like, why do all these guys get to decide that nothing is going to be done unless you girls want to go, you know, have a pillow fight with him and make his face bleed? That's cool. But that's it. You know what I mean? It like only gives me just enough satisfaction, and then it just drops back down again.
It's kind of almost too the only redeeming moment for Nomi's character in the whole movie. I mean, we talked earlier about how Molly is the only good person in the movie, and she gets so badly messed over in this movie. And Nomi's such a terrible human being all the way throughout. But this is like just the teensy littlest bit of redemption for Nomi's character.
Yep, 100%. And she's like, you know what? If this gets back to them and I get in trouble, or at this point, she's realized she's not quite as concerned of being this star in the show. She's like, whoa, like my friend was right. There's some really dark things, and either I'm going to have to live in this dark world to look glamorous on stage, or I can go back to my roots and figure out whatever I'm going to do, but I need to protect my friends. And ultimately that's protecting who I am and my morals and how I want to live my life. So that moment does give you a glimpse of like, okay, I think she's going to start heading in the direction of like some sanity, maybe, because she's done a lot of insane things all of a sudden.
And speaking to that, to a certain degree, there's a moment in the film where Nomi kind of realizes that all of a sudden the target is on her back. There's one particular part where one of the other dancers says something to Nomi along the lines of, can I be your understudy? Or maybe I can be your understudy, Nomi, something like that. And she kind of has this realization of like, oh, if I stick around here much longer, I'm going to be the one going down the stairs next.
Yeah. And she's like, wow, it's a cycle. And she also knew, because that dancer that asked was the one who stuck up for her and lied and said that Nomi didn't push the other principal down the stairs and vice versa. So now she's like, shoot, I've got this pact with this person. I don't want to have a pact with this person. Like, but you know, I'm basically at her expense, because she could change my life for good or bad. And with this information that she has on me. And she was like, wow, I think she realizes I got to figure out what to do. It's either you stay in it or you get out of it.
There's a pretty large part of this film that focuses on the lifestyle of the showgirl as well. And it's portrayed as being a big party for the most part. I mean, they are hanging out at big events with celebrities, and they're partying at nightclubs, and they're attending boat shows and conventions and things like that. How accurate was that?
I mean, again, that was definitely boosted up a few notches. Now the boat show thing that they did, we did the show, and then a lot of girls would work other gigs, and usually in gigs in town, it's a lot of convention work. You know, it's like modeling type work where there's always an event, there's always a convention, there's always some company looking for, you know, atmosphere performers. So yes, on our downtime or free time, we do usually do those types of things. And now that moment there was kind of cheesy and, you know, it's like the two guys come again. No, we go, the company will provide us our costumes and we do our couple hours. We get a half hour break on and off. And it's like, you know, anywhere from 2 to 5 hours, depending on what the job is. And then we go home, we get our paycheck. And the lifestyle itself, yes, when you're doing working a show, you know, a lot of times you don't have to be into work until, depending on the show, 5, 6, 7, even 9 o'clock. You know, when I did Crazy Girls, our call time was 8:30. Show was at 9:30. So yes, you can sleep in more. And then that means after the show, you know, you don't want to go home and just go to bed. Your adrenaline's up. Even if you do try to, if you just go home right after the show, I'll eat my dinner. I'm still up for a few hours. So the nightlife is a little bit more prominent just because it's your lifestyle. But in order to do a show 6 nights a week that aggressively, you're not partying your face off every single night. You just wouldn't be able to do it. You wouldn't be able to keep your body physically fit and the strength and stamina to be able to have an aggressive job like this.
When you were working as a showgirl, did you ever have one of those experiences that kind of made you take a step back and go, holy crap, like if it wasn't for the fact that I was in this show, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing right now?
When I was in Jubilee, I mean, there's CeeLo Green, Britney Spears, J-Lo. We did things with all of them. For example, Britney Spears, when she announced her residency here in Vegas, she was doing this whole thing over down at the Link, and they had this outdoor stage where she was getting a key to the city. So, and they wanted to film that. So they had after Jubilee, after our show that night at midnight, this one number called Red Fans, they had those dancers. We had all of our things, our costume, the wardrobe person came, the producer, and we went across the street and we got changed in the back area and set up. And we did the number. We did a number to her music that, you know, we staged and everything, spent a day rehearsing on stage. And then she walked out, she got her key, and it was televised. And then with J-Lo, she loved Jubilee so much that she used that number, Red Fans number, in her show, at least the costumes and the fans, to one of her tracks. And when she did the, what was it, the New Year's Eve show, I think it was at Caesar's Palace, maybe not, but that one time. So we did that and she loved it so much, and she loved the costumes and the fans, that when she announced her residency in Vegas, she did it on the Ellen show. And so she had about 10 of us dancers and the producer and the wardrobe flown to LA. And we were there for a full day, and we got to dance on the Ellen show with J-Lo and then take pictures with her. And so because of things like that, I've had a lot of really awesome experiences that I'll never forget, because, you know, it is Vegas and everybody wants to do the Vegas bigger and better, right? And when you're in a show like Jubilee, it draws attention to celebrities because they're like, oh, like you, those costumes are so unique. You know, the Bob Mackie design, some of those costumes cost $10,000-$20,000. So if, you know, a celebrity can incorporate that, especially if they're going to be working in Vegas, what's more Vegas than that?
So the verdict then, I mean, how close is this movie to the showgirl's lifestyle? I feel like after having this conversation with you, if I was to put it on a 0 to 10 scale of realistic, I would probably put it at about a 2.
100%. And the thing is like those one-off moments, like, yes, there might've been, you know, in a 6-month period where I had friends in town, and after the show, you know, maybe one weekend, we spent a whole weekend and partied our faces off after I would get off the show. And then that whole weekend, the week after, I felt like crap. But that was one moment in a 6-month contract that happened, you know? And so they took all those one-off moments and made it, you know, a huge extra over the top, this is the way the life is kind of movie.
You know, actually looking back on our conversation and all the things we went over here, I'm actually starting to think that maybe a 2 out of 10 is actually being a little too generous.
Yes, I'd agree. Maybe let's give it like a 1.2.
Danny, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun, and I've enjoyed having you on to have this conversation. And now I'm going to have to go watch the movie again for like the third time this week. My wife is getting a little suspicious of the situation. I'm not going to lie.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I was really excited. You wanted to talk Showgirls with me. I love talking Showgirls, and I love talking about that movie because I think we could probably have this conversation in another 20 years from now, and it'll still be valid.
I always had a private doctor. I didn't think I needed VA care. Then I learned VA is ranked above private care systems nearby and costs less. I'm getting the best care of my life with providers trained to treat veterans. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.